Our next guest is RNZ investigative journalist Kirsty Johnston.
In 2022, I was scrolling through my junk folder when I stumbled upon an intriguing email. It was a woman in the UK hunting for the truth about her conception and birth at one of New Zealand's most notorious psychiatric facilities.
Someone needs to at least answer some questions about this, you know? Someone must know something.
That's from Kirsty Johnstone's new podcast. It's called Nellie's Baby, and it's the result of a year-long investigation by the RNZ journalist. It all started when Kirsty received that unusual email. The subject line said, quote, "investigating the possible murder of my mother," unquote. The email was from a woman named Sarah, whom you heard there. She'd been adopted as a baby in the 1980s. Sarah wanted to find the truth about her birth mother, Nellie, a former psychiatric patient at Porirua Mental Hospital, and who died in 2008, before Sarah had a chance to meet her. Sarah was suspicious that Nellie may have been deliberately killed, and that her own birth may have been the result of a sexual assault by a staff member at the hospital. Sarah and Kirsty have spent the last year combing through official records, doing DNA tests, and tracking down long-lost family members, hoping to get to the bottom of Sarah's mother's story. Along the way, they've investigated the dark history of New Zealand's psychiatric institutions. I asked Kirsty what it was like getting that unexpected email from Sarah.
Well, I was sitting at home. I was living in Tauranga at the time and working remotely, and I was doing a solid bit of procrastinating, and I'd kind of run through all my usual procrastinatory tactics, and I thought, I'll just have a look at my junk email, which I don't normally do. I don't think anyone does do that.
It's got to be cleaned out every now and then. So you went into your junk file to clean your junk file out. Yeah, that's legit.
It's a bit of a punishing task, really. It's normally just the kind of the haters in there. But I had an email from a young woman from the UK called Sarah, and the title of that email was "Investigating the Possible Murder of My Mother." And, I mean, that's not an email subject line that you get every day. So right from then, I was kind of hooked on the story.
Hello. I wondered if you might be the person to help me, or if you'd be able to put me in contact with a good New Zealand investigative journalist familiar with Porirua Mental Institution. It's a long story, but here are some key things. My mother, my birth mother, that is, was relatively normal until she started coming back from work, apparently, at age 14, looking dishevelled and wetting herself. She then went away for an eye operation, according to my auntie, for 8 months and was never the same and regressed to the age of an eight-year-old. My auntie tried to look into if this was indeed as she suspects, because she had a child, and was told to let sleeping dogs lie. I'd like to find out if I have a brother or sister or if the baby died. She was then put into Porirua Mental Institution at age 15 or 16, I think, and lived there until 1984, when she was 45 years of age and became pregnant with me. My auntie suspects this was at the hands of the social worker, possibly. I was born and then adopted out and was one of New Zealand's last completely closed adoptions. By the time I made contact with my birth family in New Zealand a few years ago, on my mother's side, my mother had sadly passed away.
So what did Sarah know at the point she contacted you, and who was she even?
So Sarah grew up here in New Zealand, and she moved to the UK when she was about 18. She was adopted as a baby, and she knew that. But when she was in her early 20s, she found out from her adopted parents that her mum had actually been in a psychiatric hospital for her whole life. So her adoption was really unusual, and that there was really limited information around it. And Sarah had been kind of thinking about this for more than 10 years and finally decided that she really wanted to look into her mother's life.
What did she know by the point she contacted you?
So she knew that her mum had been in Porirua Psychiatric Hospital. She knew she had died in 2008, which is really upsetting, obviously, because Sarah had tried to make contact with her family, but she was too late and Nellie had died. And she knew there was like a little bit of suspicion around that death because she'd talked to Nellie's sister. And she also knew that the family believed that Nellie may have had another baby when she was really young, when she was a teenager, so that she possibly had a sibling somewhere out there.
Was it Mavis, Nellie's sister, who first raised the possibility of foul play?
Yeah, I think it was Mavis and some of the rest of the family. They had, because Nellie had been a compulsory patient, mental health patient, there was a full coroner's hearing, and they had an autopsy report, and that's what kind of led them to think there may have been something suspicious about Nellie's death.
So, what was the process of trying to get to the bottom of that, and what was learned?
Process was mainly a lot of time and a lot of phone calls, really. Everyone thinks investigative journalism is like very glamorous and sexy, I think, and a lot of meeting with people in dark car parks and wearing trench coats. But actually, it was mainly paper-based research. Particularly when we tried to hunt down Sarah's father, and we had to use DNA, and then you have to kind of match that against a whole bunch of things like birth records and council records and gravestones and all that kind of stuff, which is just really, it's just a real slog.
There had been some injuries, I think. That was that part of what raised suspicion towards the end of her life?
Yeah, so Sarah has a little bit of medical training. So when she read the autopsy report by the pathologist, she was able to kind of interpret some of what was on there. And, yeah, there was like a brain injury kind of hinted at in there. And Nellie, when she died, she'd been living in a psychogeriatric hospital. And she had a lot of bone fractures and she had bruises all over her and that kind of thing. So it immediately raised suspicion for Sarah.
It could have been unintended. It could have been a fall from a bed. But there was suspicion there. And then you mentioned Sarah also wanting to get to the bottom of who her father was. And why was this? Was there also an hypothesis of how she came to be conceived?
Yes. So Nellie, when she fell pregnant with Sarah, was 43 years old and she was living in a psychiatric hospital. And for some reason, like, they didn't know who the father was. There was this idea that it might have been her boyfriend at the time. But he was a Samoan guy called Johnny. And when Sarah was born, she was very pink and like, very obviously not Samoan. And so they had to kind of go back to the drawing board. And I think somewhere some suspicion crept in that maybe it had been like a doctor or a social worker or something like that. So we really were suspecting the worst because, of course, you know, Catherine, you know how things happen in places like that in the history of psychiatric care in New Zealand. So we really were kind of thinking worst case scenario when we started out.
Not giving too much away, however, on the course of the podcast to say that Sarah took a DNA test and found out who her father was, and he was a former Porirua patient.
Yeah, it was really good to have that because it is quite a difficult story, Nellie's story. And so to find Sarah's dad and to find that it wasn't this kind of awful thing that we assumed was a really nice moment. And I actually was just listening to the episode where we meet him this morning, and I felt myself welling up with tears, even though it's my own work. Like, it really is lovely to have been able to reintroduce those people. It's quite a rare moment in journalism to have something like that happen.
Was it at all unusual from your research for psychiatric patients to either be in a relationship or to have sex with each other and indeed to have children? What did you learn?
Well, I don't think it was unusual for them to have sex at all. It was obviously frowned upon. We found out that at some points it was actually illegal for anyone to have sex with a female patient. There was fines and jail terms attached to that. And then the law softened a little bit, but definitely at the time when Sarah was born, yeah, it was still illegal. But of course, you know, humans are humans, and just because people are disabled or because they have mental health issues doesn't mean that they don't have sex lives. So we didn't find out about any other babies at Porirua or other places, but I feel like there must have been lots of them.
It coincides with another time or issue of the era, doesn't it, which is what happens when women out of wedlock were pregnant. There's probably a lot of untold stories here and potentially other adoptions here, Kirsty.
Yeah, I think so. The time that Nellie might have had this first baby would have been in the 50s, and that was a particularly, you know, draconian time in terms of forced adoption. And, you know, there's that movie, Gone Up North. You know, she's gone up north for a while, that whole thing where women would just disappear if they got pregnant, particularly young women.
It was the 1969 Mental Health Act that made it a crime for anyone to have sex with a female psych patient. And
yeah.
Now, what have you learned? Now the law is more around whether consent is possible, yeah?
Yeah. I think it is more about consent. It's really difficult because those early laws were written, like, you can look at them and think that they might be being caring towards patients, that they don't want them taken advantage of. But you also have to remember that there was the whole eugenics movement, and they actually didn't want, you know, mental health patients or disabled women having babies. So the genesis is quite complicated, and I'm not really sure where we've got to now. I think it is more of that caretaker, you know, role, but yeah, it's definitely still not a topic that you hear about every day, is it?
Sarah, and again, I don't want to give everything away, but I think this part of the story we can talk about. She had a chance to meet her father and
yes.
his family, but this happens in the most bizarre circumstances. Kirsty, can you explain?
Well, yeah, this is kind of on me. I don't know. I wasn't really thinking straight when we set up the meeting, but Sarah and I had decided that we would go and look at the museum that's on the former site of the Porirua Psychiatric Hospital. So we were going up to look at what was a former lunatic asylum, you know, where patients had been kept in really, you know, awful circumstances. There'd been horrible stuff gone there, well, what we can consider horrible now. And that's the day that we decided to also meet her, you know, birth aunt for the first time. And so, yeah, we ended up there with this whole conflation of things, and it was just so many feelings for everyone.
I did it. It was a bit too much. It felt too much. Everything feels a bit too much at the moment because it's, I don't know, they're really big, scary feelings, and you don't know how to feel. You don't know whether to feel excited or feel happy or feel scared or feel nervous or feel sad or worried or anxious. There's just too many, so I can't really label them all, and then I just keep having meltdowns and crying. So yesterday was okay and it went fine. It's just that, I don't know, what if my dad doesn't like me, or what if, I don't know, I'm not wanted again, or I don't know, lots of feelings.
And like, it did work out, but even now I just think, gosh, I could have planned that one a little bit better.
She'd found the aunt, I think, again using DNA and just
yes.
using one of the websites, right? And then she didn't meet her father that day. She met him soon after, though, right?
Yeah, she didn't meet him on that day, thankfully, because there was already quite a lot going on. I think that visit to the museum, it's really different hearing about somebody's experience in a place like Porirua Hospital, and then visiting. I think both her aunt and Sarah took a long time to kind of process what they'd heard and seen after that visit.
Things like the ECT machines.
Yeah, the ECT machines.
Which are still on display there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, in the seclusion room where you can see, you know, there's claw marks on the walls and things like that where patients have tried to get out. I think the physical reality of that is really confronting for anyone, even if you haven't had a family member in there. And Sarah had two family members in there. So, it was a difficult day.
This has been an area for much more reflection recently, obviously, with the Royal Commission of Inquiry into Abuse and State Care. And everybody has learned more about what people went through. But you were there and they were there imagining what their loved ones had gone through.
Yeah, and we listened, well, I listened to a lot of the testimony from the Royal Commission. So when we visited, I'd actually been to the museum before for work, and I knew that it was going to be difficult, and I, you know, without being too kind of overbearing, I tried to warn Sarah and her aunt that it might be a difficult time. But even for me, I'd spent all these weeks, you know, listening, reading, learning about what people had gone through. And it's not that long ago. I think that's something that I was really struck by. Like, it's only the 50s, you know, it's recent memory. And so even for me, it was really confronting going back there.
RNZ journalist Kirsty Johnston is our guest. We're talking about her new podcast. It's called Nellie's Baby. You're listening to 9 to Noon with Catherine Ryan on RNZ National. What did you learn about how Nellie ended up in Porirua in the first place?
It took us a really long time to find out about her admission, and we still haven't got her records from Porirua. We really struggled to try and get them, so what we've got has kind of been patched together through her family's memories and through other records later from people who, fortunately for us, had read her file and then summarised it, bless them. But yeah, we learned that she, like most people, had some kind of breakdown. Her family doctor recommended she go in there. She was only 20. And it seems really complex about her diagnosis and everything, because we think, you know, she might have had a baby as a teenager, so there could be some trauma there. Some of her material had that she was schizophrenic written on it. So, yeah, it was really difficult trying to unpick exactly how, you know, what led her to be incarcerated there, because she was there for her whole life after that, from age 20 to when it closed in the 90s.
Do we know much about Nellie and Gordon's life at Porirua? Were you able to access any kind of records or learn any more?
Yeah, we interviewed, fortunately, some former patients. One in particular was there at the same time as Nellie, so we were able to learn about her experience there, which was horrendous. I mean, we're really grateful for her because, yeah, there's a bit of a black box knowing exactly what went on there. And I think what I found really difficult was you get a lot of the formal history is from staff or from, you know, historians and things like that who interviewed staff about their experience, and those experiences are just totally different to what the patients will tell you, what former patients will tell you. So being able to talk to people who were there as patients was invaluable.
We've talked about sex, but smoking is another theme of the podcast.
Yeah, that it comes up in almost every single document you read or every conversation you have with somebody, how addicted all the patients were to cigarettes, to the point that staff kind of used them as a trade system. If they wanted the patients to help them do a chore, you know, they would say, "Oh, if you do this, we'll give you a cigarette." But it had really, obviously, dire health consequences, and also, you know, it kind of added to institutionalisation. You know, Nellie, for example, would have done anything for a cigarette, and she learned some quite drastic behaviour in there, like hurting herself, you know, that's the extent she'd go to try and get a cigarette off somebody.
And even when she was pregnant and they were trying to encourage her to cut down, she was just completely addicted, yeah?
Yeah, and like, it's hard because you look back from a modern perspective and you think, oh, how could somebody do that? But nicotine's a powerful drug, and when you add in, you know, people's disabilities or mental health problems on top of that, and then you add in the fact that that's all she's known forever, you know, you have to really suspend judgment. I found that really, really sad, to be honest.
Nellie's daughter came to you because she wanted an answer to the question on the possibility of whether her mother had been murdered.
Yeah.
Were you able to categorically find an answer to that?
I think we were. I personally came to the view that it wasn't necessarily suspicious. I think Sarah and I might have arrived at different points there. But I'll let her speak for her own views on the podcast. But yeah, I think more than anything, I was struck by the fact that Nellie's story wasn't necessarily unique. I mean, lots of women would have been put in places like Porirua at the same time as her because they had a learning disability or they had post-birth trauma or, you know, things that today we would treat, I hope we would treat through the medical system. And instead they were just kind of locked up and left for their whole lives. So I don't know, even though, you know, I don't necessarily think her death was criminal, it didn't really make me feel any better to come to that conclusion.
You say in the podcast that we were really uneasy about taking on this project in the first place, and why was that?
I think I'd been working on stories about sexual violence and women and the family court for quite a few years, and when I got Sarah's letter, I had just that week decided I was going to give it up. I felt like it was really taking a toll on my mental health, and I wanted to change tack, and I have. I've started reporting on climate change, but I did take on Sarah's project because it just felt like to me, I've done a lot of reporting on disability and a lot of reporting on women, and it felt like this real coming together of all of these areas that, you know, I felt, I don't know, kind of a responsibility for. And I'm really glad that I did it. I mean, it wasn't easy. It wasn't an easy job, but I'm really glad that we did the podcast and really proud of it.
What have you taken away from the experience of working on it and working with Sarah and others?
I think the main thing I've learned is just how complex people are. It always surprises me, Catherine. You know, you think you've learned everything about the human race in this job as a reporter, and then you meet new people and just the way, like, how resilient people are, how generous they are. Like, when Sarah's aunt Sharon found out about her, she flew here from Perth to meet her, and I just thought that was so beautiful that even though we were doing this work that was inherently quite dark, there were moments like that that it was just like a bit of humanity that shone through. Yeah, so it was nice for me to be reminded that.
Kirsty Johnston, the RNZ investigative journalist, and you can find her new podcast telling this story in more detail. It's called Nellie's Baby. You can find it on RNZ's series and podcasts page or wherever you get your podcasts from.